The inside story behind the latest sales. Will fuel cells really sell? And why is Carlos Ghosn losing so many executives?
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 256 for September 5th. Why luxury brands are murdering mass market cars. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash.
John, good to see you again.
Good to see you. I mean, we see each other passing on these new car launch trips that we go on, and it's good to run it.
Occasionally we're in the studio together at the same time.
And we're truly co-hosts this time, yeah.
Funny how that works.
We also got to let everybody know we're joined by Dave Sullivan from Auto Pacific. Great having you here, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And Joe White from the Wall Street Journal. And we love having you guys on because this is a show for people who really know and care about the automotive industry, and we've got you guys to help tell that story tonight.
And I just got to say, there was a comment from the chat room, and for those who are watching and seeing that there were some technical difficulties, Maverick writes in and said, who hit the ignition key with their right knee and shut this thing off?
So there's a raging storm going on outside. Thunder and lightning and all kinds of rain. So
there'll be no recall.
Right. Right. Yeah, you get what you have.
Well, to me, the big news, I think, this week is the car sales. We saw in August like we haven't seen in August in, I don't know, how long.
8 years, yeah.
You know, a SAR of 17.4, 17.5, something like that. And boy, just about everybody had a great month. I think Jaguar Land Rover were down, and somebody else was down.
Volkswagen
was down.
Some of the GM brands were down.
Well, I'm going on an adjusted.
Oh, yeah, I go on unadjusted, but that's fine.
Yeah. So, but still, I mean, everybody had a pretty good month. But, Dave, you're the analyst in the group. What did you make of it?
I was most impressed by the Accord. Nobody was really expecting over 50,000.
Is that what they did?
Yeah, over 50,000 last month. That's unbelievable.
That is unbelievable.
There's a lot of model year-end activity.
Yeah.
I heard on that car as well.
Yeah, they're clearing everything out. But, I mean, still, to sell that, that's a lot of activity.
Lot of
I mean, they don't have as many dealers as, you know,
Toyota.
Detroit 3 or Toyota. So that's a lot of metal to be moving through your showroom.
That was at 51,000 versus Camry at 44,000. So, I mean, that's a pretty big delta. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Those
two. And as Honda will happily point out, they're all retail.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The Accord's that.
Well, and it's, you know, a couple things, right? I mean, first of all, you know, Honda and Toyota, for that matter, have a remarkably durable brands and brand appeal. And you know, when they put discounts on something, the cars move off the lot. And not every brand can say that. But yeah, I think it's interesting. I've written about this. There's been a bunch of debate going on over whether the U.S. market has plateaued at 16.5,
right,
you know, prior to this last month's number, or whether it's on its march to 18 or 19. I'm maybe personally in the glass half empty party to some degree, but this last month it was awful hard to write a story that says that you've reached a peak in demand. So we have to see what happens in the next couple of months.
Well, we could have reached a peak. But the evidence doesn't show it.
Right.
Not yet.
You know, another interesting thing about Honda is according to TrueCar numbers, their incentive spending is way low compared to the other vehicle manufacturers. So people who are buying those Accords are spending money.
Yeah. No, I do think they had some promotional activity on the Accord. But you know, relative to some others, probably not that bad.
Well, you know, some of the incentive stuff, you got to be careful because Nissan's incentives are way down. But that's because they cut their MSRPs. And that's how car companies play with how much revenue are we going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll give the dealer a bunch of money to help close the sale. Or do you say, no, let's just lower prices. And when people do their internet searches, we look the best.
Or you flood
rental
car and fleet markets, and you can say your incentive spend was still down.
Right.
But you didn't really, you're not giving an incentive to you're, you know, fleet buyers. So your incentive spend looks really low, but,
yeah, but
you
Honda
sold
doesn't
it.
Do that.
No, Honda doesn't do that, exactly.
You know, so their incentive spend was $18.25, and you can compare that to General Motors at $36.76, Ford $31.05, Chrysler $34.76. I mean, so it's again a big difference between what they're putting on the hoods of their cars versus what the other guys are.
Well, that goes to the point about the durability of their brand appeal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a strong brand. The other thing that was interesting about sales numbers, which is kind of a more and more from recent months, is the pull on SUVs versus sedans and compact cars for the most part, you know, in general. You know, gas prices at whatever the, you know, whatever region of the country you're in, 350 to 4. I guess in California it's closer to 4. But still,
California is over 4.
Yeah, but stable.
Right.
At sort of that level, and stable in the Midwest at under 4. It's remarkable how quickly demand, we were talking to folks at Toyota about this last night, how quickly demand for SUVs, you know, and crossovers, but sort of SUV concept, which is not necessarily the most efficient, even in a crossover, the most efficient use of a C platform, B platform, CD platform, but that's what people really want, and that's where the real pull is in the market. It's interesting to see the American consumer kind of snapping back to the, you know, give me my space, give me my fanny pack in the back, you know.
And give me my power, because one thing that I found very interesting is the Chevrolet Corvette outsold the Chevrolet Volt.
Well, sign of the times.
Doesn't that say that? And, you know, Corvette sales are up like 300% plus.
Well, let's give some credit where credit is due. It's a nice-looking car.
It's a fantastic car.
Yeah.
There's no question.
They've done a good job with that.
But Volt sales are down 25%.
But the Corvette's new. The Volt is old.
Yeah.
And, you know, so
But
so
the Leaf is
that.
Old, and Leaf keeps going up.
Right.
Well, and the Leaf, but depending on where you're at in the country, I mean, it's always fascinating. It was fascinating since I figured this out. In certain states, Georgia in particular, the Leaf is practically free. If you pack on the incentives and you sort of give yourself credit for the savings in gasoline, and you lead a certain lifestyle.
It's basically a free car. I have a friend that lives in Atlanta that has one.
I think that's their number one market now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of them. It's high. It's number two or number one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it all comes down to kind of the total cost of ownership, right?
Yeah.
I forget which service talks about that a lot, but, you know, consumers are smart. They get this stuff.
Collectively.
Yeah.
Collectively, the market makes rational decisions over time.
Over time. Although with the Corvette, maybe not so much. That's an emotional decision.
Well, I got 29 miles per gallon driving to Traverse City and back in that car. It was great.
Yeah,
so,
well,
I mean, what could be more rational?
There's other
than
ways
that?
To get 29 miles per gallon. I'm just saying, you don't have to buy a Corvette to get that.
The other big news, I thought, in the sales numbers is Toyota moved ahead of Ford, became the number two car company in the U.S. for the month. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that they'll end up there for the year,
well,
but
I do. I didn't see it confirmed, but I did hear that the F-Series, the GM pickup truck, Silverado and Sierra combined, outsold F-Series last month.
I'd cut Ford some slack now. There's got to be some sort of, you know, as they transition from the old to the new, they're going to lose sales.
I think their story is that they're sort of husbanding their inventory while they do this transition, which, you know, they'll tell you is going to take three months.
Yeah, with Super Duty, they have about 110 days of inventory on hand. So F-150 and Super Duty combined.
Yeah, well, in the large pickup truck segment, the brand I've been watching, though, is Ram. They've been making big moves, and I forget exactly what their numbers were this last month.
43,000?
They were up a lot, yeah, and which was closer to being within shouting distance of the Silverado's numbers for the month than I think they've been in quite some time.
There, you got it there.
Yeah,
Silverado was 48.
They've gained a couple of points of share in that segment, which I'm sure.
Silverado 49,201, Ram 43,775.
Yeah, and up what? And Ram was up what? It was a double digit number, wasn't
33%.
It? 33%. Yeah, actually a large double digit number. So they're, you know, and again, I'm sure there's going to be arguments about how they're doing that, but they're doing it. And it's interesting how they've taken a relatively old truck.
Sure.
They've put some nice bits on it. They put in, you know, this nifty transmission in it.
Air suspension. Things that nobody else is doing.
Redid some things in the interior and the exterior, and presto changeo, they have a vehicle that's selling very well, and I'm sure that they're delighted at Fiat Chrysler for the cash flow.
Sure, it'll pay all the bills to redo Alpha.
Right. Well, it pretty much will, won't it? Has to. Yeah.
It's got to. You know, the one good news that I saw for Chrysler, I mean, Chrysler's doing great, right? Except when it comes to passenger cars. I think one out of five vehicles they sell is a traditional passenger car. But Dart was up strong. Charger was up strong. The new Chrysler 200 did pretty well, too, if I remember right. Gary,
it's up,
Gary's
up 7%.
For what? Which one was up
200. 10,810 units sold.
Yeah, they're still building.
But they're still not anywhere. I mean, you know, they're still quite a ways back in the pack.
Yeah,
in the midsize.
Oh yeah,
and that segment.
Very much.
From what I understand, Dave, you probably.
I mean, look at we were just talking about Accord selling over 50,000.
Yeah. Right, right.
Last month,
and that segment is becoming much. I mean, it's always been very competitive. It's in one of its more competitive modes right now. I think partly because I think a lot of people who might have bought a midsize sedan 4 years ago or 5 years ago are buying a midsize SUV.
Toyota. Do this, you know, Camry, I mean, a major refresh.
2.5 years.
Yeah, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then also the Sonata.
In fact, think about
Sonata's
it.
Well, the Sonata's new. The Camry, though, that new Camry isn't really out yet. So that doesn't
count. But I'm saying,
will that make...
But that's how competitive it is to force Toyota's hand to move that product life cycle up.
When the Camry comes out, will Fusion be the oldest in the segment?
Maybe. Depends on how you count it, right? Malibu is...
Malibu just got a refresh.
Malibu refresh. The Kia might be older.
Yeah.
Optima.
Yeah.
Well, but,
yeah,
but your point, right. John, your point, I agree with your point. Your point is, you know, yesterday's, you know, fresh darling is today's, you know, had been there, done that.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the product cycles are kind of back to a certain relentlessness in that segment.
Yeah, the oldest or some of the oldest cars in the segment are still pretty fresh.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, one number that surprised me, speaking of Toyota and speaking of General Motors, as you earlier were, that you've always been critical of Prius and things like that.
Yeah.
Prius outsold the Chevy Cruze by two vehicles.
So are you counting the C in there?
Well, it's Prius, okay?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
The whole number.
The family
Prius. Yeah, but come on, you know that it was. But, well, we're not taking out the Cruze diesel. It's a different car.
That's the same body style.
The sand.
I've said all along, Prius has smashed it out of the park. Not the C, not the V, the traditional
Prius. Classic.
But what I find very interesting is if you look at green cars as a group, and I'm including hybrids, plug-in hybrids, and pure electrics, the segment is not growing. Now, plug-ins and electrics are, but all we're seeing is people come out of their hybrids into plug-ins and electrics, and the segment is not growing
at
all.
Well, but the model count within that segment is growing.
And
so
it is.
Sort of the pie is... roughly the same size, but the number of slices is getting larger.
Right. But I got to give a shout out to BMW because they sold more than 1,000 i3s. And that, for that car, is not a bad number.
That's not a bad number.
Mm-hmm. That thing's basically...
It's brand new.
It's a supercar, though. Think about it. Carbon fiber, aluminum. Mm-hmm. I mean...
All electric.
I mean, for $42,000, I mean, this is...
Yeah.
This is kind of...
So 1,000 of those, to me, is not a bad number. Not going to shake up the market.
No, but you're right. I agree that the segment, you know, sort of electrics and plug-in hybrids, is growing. It appears to be growing much slower than people might have guessed again several years ago, and it's not hard anymore to sort of go around to presentations by automakers or big suppliers who just sort of say, plug-in electrics. You know, we're not looking for a lot of growth there.
Everybody wants to do this is the number we have to sell in California. Right. That's how many we're going to make.
With the obvious exception of Elon Musk, who I think today, I think, was announcing in Nevada more or less as we speak that he's putting in $500 million, you know, cars worth of battery capacity in Reno, Nevada. So he obviously disagrees with the point I just made.
Well, he does. And, you know, in fact, Gary, one of the things I know you wanted to talk about is the transition to the hydrogen economy, if it's ever going to happen.
Well, I mean, there was a study that was done out of University of California, Davis, and they seem to believe that we're at a conceivable tipping point here. Now, this I was thinking when you're talking about this and talking about what Elon's doing out there in Nevada, that your original point about how gas prices have seemed to be moderate and steady, and consequently people are looking for big things, which would consequently mean that for purposes of just transportation, not purposes of meeting some regulatory requirement, whether it's CARB or anybody else's, the bloom may be even fading somewhat faster from things like electric vehicles or full hydrogen vehicles.
I think in the mass market, yes.
That's exactly.
I mean, people buy it. I mean, there's lots of reasons to buy a Tesla, many good reasons to buy a Tesla. But I think probably one of the ones that gets underappreciated is the extent to which it's a true status symbol. You know, it's just the coolest kid on the block. So I think, you know, Elon Musk got that right, where he said, electric cars, should we make them science projects or should we make it the coolest car you can possibly buy? He chose the latter, and he was right about that. But how much, you know, that drives the mass market, I don't know.
And going back to our point earlier about maybe the Fusion and the Optima being, you know, yesterday's news, even though they're still pretty fresh, once that BMW i8 is out, how many people are going to go, hey, forget the Tesla Model S, I want the latest.
Well, that's right, and there are a lot of numbers between i3 and i8, right? So you have to assume, and I've been there, they got a big old factory there making very few carbon fiber cars right now. So I have to assume, and I think they've kind of hinted, that there'll be more, you know, in that band. And if, as you say, if they start going after kind of the Model S or even a Model X, you know, the SUV concept, that could be really interesting competition in there.
Yeah, they didn't buy a composite company to make a few.
Audi's working on a Model X
novelty X.
But I mean, to talk about hydrogen, you know, that's something that Elon Musk has really poo-pooed.
Well, he calls them fuel cells, fuel cells.
Well, and I love the sort of, you know, Gigantor versus Mothra kind of aspect to this, you know, where you know, you've got these two really, you know, powerful forces, Toyota, powerful force, Elon Musk, force of nature, powerful force. Not, you know, look at his market cap, not to be trifled with. And you're right. I mean, it's interesting to see such conflicting points of view about the future. I mean, if you're a California regulator, your head must be just spinning around, right? Which, who do I believe? You know, Elon or our former friends at Toyota.
Yeah.
Yeah, his former friends, exactly. Because, I mean, the RAV4 EV is pretty much done. And, you know, they were buying that battery from Tesla. And, you know, Toyota's basically said, well, we believe hydrogen is the way to go. So.
Yeah, I don't believe that they really believe that, though.
You don't?
No, I keep coming back to the point that it's all about ZEV credits. And if you want to get the max ZEV credits,
you have to have
a 300-mile-plus range and fast refuel.
Yeah.
Fast refuel being defined as 80% fill capability in less than 5 minutes. This is why Elon went with the replaceable batteries.
Yeah, you can't do it.
So he cannot get those full ZEV credits.
Yeah, right.
So anyway,
selling and making money on.
Yeah, he makes good.
So this is why everybody went, oh, 7 credits, you know, and I only can get 3 with a Leaf-like vehicle. I'm going for the 7 credits.
Yeah, right now it's a regulatory market as opposed to a consumer market. And, you know, while you were going to say something about hydrogen, I mean, my big question about hydrogen is
we'll get back to hydrogen. Dr. Botox calls me out saying that the number for the Prius and the Cruise are different. So just so you know, this is the totally Prius number.
Okay, hold on, because we're going to a commercial break. Hold that thought.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay. Now that we're back here after our nice little break from our friends at Firestone, Gary, you were saying Dr. Botox was saying what?
He called me out because basically he was saying what you guys were saying, that basically I had the collective Prius number, not the Prius Classic and the Prius V and the Prius C and the Prius plug-in, just the Prius number which Toyota reports out. So if we look at that mass number, we compare it to the Cruise, it outsells the Cruise by 2 vehicles. And realize the Cruise was General Motors or Chevy's biggest selling car by far. And so that was actually down this month. So it gets back to what you were saying originally about people wanting things bigger. So they're buying Silverado. You know, they go into the dealership, Oh, I think I want to buy a cruise. No, that Silverado looks nice.
Well, and again, I'm not, you know, GM isn't special in this. I mean, everybody was running promotions, but you know, it could well be you could get a Silverado for around the same monthly payment as a cruise this last month. They were pushing them hard on the A plan. I know around here.
Oh yeah, $244 a month with $244 down lease.
Are you kidding? For Silverado?
For a double cab, yeah, 4x4.
Yeah, as well.
What are we sitting here for?
Really, this is a Chevy dealer up the street.
Cars, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just interesting. I mean, if you catch the promotional waves, right, all kinds of funny things happen that you wouldn't necessarily expect.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I think that, you know, to the point of hydrogen, I mean, in these studies that these guys are doing is they're basically saying, okay, we're at this tipping point now. And, you know, they make a comparison to saying, okay, is hydrogen going to be, you know, the sad sister compared to electric vehicles, and I guess with Elon's $500 million today, it's going to sort of look that way compared to the number of hydrogen refueling stations that are even up and down the coast in California. But, you know, what's interesting is that they make the comparison to gasoline rather than to say, okay, let's just go head-to-head with hydrogen, with electricity, let's look at hydrogen in gasoline. And, you know, you heard about
because
that.
Because that's the closest.
Right, because
the refuel.
Yeah, you fill your tank, get 300-mile range versus fill your battery, get
90,
yeah,
80.
Or unless you're in a Model S.
Unless you're in a Model S. And you
Model S with a P85 pack.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah.
For $100,000.
Right.
Right.
That car.
Which everyone has, too.
Right.
To buy vehicles.
Right.
Speaking of expensive cars, what do you guys make of Lincoln's lackluster performance? We saw those wonderful ads yesterday, Dave. Dave
oh,
and
yes.
I saw the new Matthew McConaughey ads.
Oh, I haven't seen those.
Oh, yes, we saw them all.
Yeah, really good.
It was. I'm very puzzled. I mean, when I told people that Matthew McConaughey is now the new person for Lincoln, they're like, you know, that, you know, bongo playing ganja smoking guy is now the spokesperson.
Hey. I think they're confusing him with Woody Harrelson, his co-star in that series.
Better than John Slattery. John Slattery looked like he was. You know,
well, but John Slattery's problem is he's the demographic that Lincoln probably actually has.
Yes.
Matthew McConaughey is the demographic they'd like to have. Oh, well, there's no more free lunch for me at Lincoln.
But yeah, they did. But they didn't have a good month.
Oh, they had a horrible month. Yeah. And in fact, if it was not for the MKC just coming out.
Yeah, sold, what, 1,000 of those?
So MKZ. Change, minus 22.2%. Mm-hmm. MKS, minus 48.4%. Lincoln Cars as a total, minus 28.4%. MKX, minus 5.6%. MKX, minus 43.2%. MKT, minus 12.9%. And that was Navigator, 12.9%. So it's just it's very
well,
weak.
All
red ink.
Cadillac and Lincoln, I mean, are in different places and at different levels of volume and all of that. But I think I think both of those brands and probably the Japanese luxury brands as well, I think are really fighting an uphill battle right now with the German luxury three, who have got lots of product in a broadening fan across the market from 29.9 to, you know, 129.9 and beyond. And
not just that, I mean, they have every body style, hybrid, diesel. I mean, you'll get, you know, we got a new X1 coming, mm-hmm. X3, X4, X5, X6, X7 coming. I mean, there's so much
product on.
Yeah, BMW has so. I mean, the BMW execs were talking about this at one of the auto shows I went to in the last 12 months, and they were saying, "Look, we've got so many different variants of our many model lines. The days of 357 are so far, you know, in the past. We can't. Most of our dealers can't stock them. It's like 100. I think that's the right number. It's like 100. If you get it all, I mean, M this and all the whole thing, it's like 100 different variants. And so they're talking to their dealers, look, you need to have big screens in your dealership so that we can show people all the different vehicles that they could buy. But we can't expect you to stock them all. It's impossible. And so if you're Lincoln and you're kind of a challenger brand, which I think Ford folks have acknowledged pretty openly, challenger for real, because you're up against brands that are powerful, well-respected, and have just a zillion products to sell.
But see, what doesn't bother me, Lincoln being down, what bothers me is the Z is down. The other products, that's the old Lincoln, right? The Z is the first of the new Lincoln. It's dead in the water. The C, like you say, Gary, that helped them a little bit. They sold 1,000 or something, though, right?
The C.
1700.
So let's have fun with numbers. Do a if you go back a year, what was the Z selling, and then what is the C and the Z together selling in this month?
All right. So last year, year to date.
Yeah. Well, or just the month.
Yeah. All right. So last August they sold 3,652 MKZs.
Mm-hmm.
And zero MKCs. This month they sold 2,841 MKZs and 1,760 MKCs.
Wow. Cannibal same okay. number.
Okay, same number. So but on the other hand I mean, you know, they might not be weeping into their gluten-free beer down there at Lincoln. They might be just fine with that number. Because you know, it seems like a certain amount of volume that they might have had in the Z walked over and bought
the
MKC
instead. Right. But they need products like the C to come in and grow this,
yes,
grow
their
share.
Right. That would be better.
Yeah. So it goes back to the pie. The pie is the same size, but now we're going to split it in different ways, and I don't think that pie is quite big enough for them. But the question comes, you know, you're saying that if you look at the German brands, that they're so very strong in that area. So given that Lincoln is comparatively weak in that area, what's the advantage of Ford Motor Company even competing in that space?
In which space?
The luxury space. What do you think, Dave?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this last week, and everybody's been talking about, oh, what's going on with Cadillac, and they're down, and what has everybody been saying about Lincoln? Oh, they need a dedicated rear-wheel drive platform, and I'm sure the Lincoln guys are just laughing right now, going, you know, we just saved all this money, didn't develop this unique platform, and Cadillac's down.
But I wouldn't read that into being a problem with rear drive cars.
I think Cadillac has work to do, and the work that I gather they are doing. But I do agree. If you look at the short term, I mean, you know, selling a C platform Ford product for 40 some thousand or whatever the average transaction price on the MKC is money in the bank to Ford, and that's probably how they look at it. And the same goes with the Z. You take a Fusion, you know, and sell it for $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, whatever it is, $1,000 more revenue per car. Again, I don't think they're crying about that. And I think for the moment, that's they. Why wouldn't they be fine with that?
I think they're really holding out. You know, okay, if it whatever happens here happens, but I think the big focus is looking at China, and that's where they really think that this brand is going to grow. I mean, they have some really aggressive plans for building dealerships there, really aggressive plans for product that's tailored to the Chinese market. I mean, and the thing that I'm a bit puzzled by, you know, I'm interested to see how much what the prices are for, like in China with these cars, because there's a, I don't know, 20-25% duty on all these cars that are made in Mexico or here and shipped to China. So how are they going to compete against the German brand cars that are made in China?
Increasingly made in China. Yeah. And, or the Cadillac cars that are being made in China.
That don't have that 25%.
Well, they know this. So. And that's why they're going to build in China.
Well, they're going to have to
localize. Of course they're going to buy and build in China.
But I mean, for the short term, I mean, to look, you know, how is Lincoln going to even grow? Or is it in China? If that's, and I think that's where the, you know, we're looking at in the future, is that they don't really have that, like, you know, this is a watered down, you know, or a gussied up Ford.
But I mean, to the point of the gussied up Ford, I mean, if you look at in Europe, I mean, there's no Lincoln in Europe, and Ford is basically, what is it, Vignale?
Vignale.
I mean, and so you know, you just add that stuff. So you just say, okay, this is a Ford, and you put stuff on top of it, and you get the $7,000 to $8,000 more, and happier because you're not supporting this second brand with Matthew McConaughey ads.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, look, I think Ford. I mean, management does seem to be very focused on revenue per vehicle. I mean, everybody is, but Ford very much seems to be focused on revenue per vehicle. And you know, they so far so good, right, on the strategy of taking, you know, the same basic platforms and kind of stretching them, you know, up into sort of luxury or near luxury sorts of price points. It'll be interesting to see all of these companies as Mercedes and BMW, Mercedes with the CLA and the GLA, are coming. You know, they're coming down into that same territory.
Look, this is a big threat to the mass market brands. Last week, I got to drive the Acura TLX. What a great car. I'm telling you, this is could be a turning point, at least product-wise, for Acura. And what struck me is it starts out at about 30 grand, maybe 31, something like that. And then as you add stuff up, you can get it over 40, easily over 40. But the point is that these luxury brands are bringing luxury attributes down into price points where the mass market brands are playing. And they're bringing in much more sophisticated suspensions, a lot more noise attenuation, kind of attention to detail, definitely better brakes. You know, the bones of the vehicles are better. Now, the mass market guys can compete right now because they're just ladling on more equipment. So even though they're the same price, the mass market brands tend to give you more content per dollar.
I mean,
the luxury guys are giving you a better car.
Yeah, I mean, I was in an A3, I don't know, a month or two ago, and it was $37,000, and it didn't have automatic climate control.
You can get that in a Passat.
Yeah, I'm like, hey, where... I expect that in an Audi.
Well, you do, and that's some of the problems as they decontent to get their prices down. But still, as I say, why buy a Ford when you can have a Mercedes?
But you're saying the fundamental bones of the car are better that you're getting from the premium brand. But I think what Dave is saying is that if I'm buying a premium brand car, I want premium brand amenities that go along with that.
I expect a certain level.
Yeah. So
the question becomes, does the average consumer who's just going out there to buy a car, the average consumer who's not going to take the car through the S turns at high rates of speed and slam on the brake and do all that stuff that we like to do when we have the chance to do that, right?
Yeah, in the 5 minutes a day that you might have a chance to do
that.
And so what are they looking for? And they're probably looking for automatic climate control, and they're not looking for, you know, a extraordinarily good suspension system.
Well, but they're going to, I think, maybe I may prove me wrong here, but it seems like the CLA is sold very well, and it has some of the same issues that the A3 does that you describe. I think the A3 is probably going to sell pretty well, and that's because Alfred P. Sloan got it right. Status still matters. You know, you can get a top, a loaded Ford Fusion is an amazing automobile with all sorts of wonderful content, but it's not an Audi.
All right.
And for some people, that's a big deal.
And
I wonder, though, I mean, I think this is going to be a really dynamic, this span between, I would say, between like 28 and 38. I'm just probably the wrong, but something like that. It's going to be incredibly dynamic because I think you're right that the A3 probably needs to have automatic climate control, and you know the Audi folks will probably figure that out. But as more of these features also become digital, you know, essentially run by chips and software, which, you know, incremental cost isn't as great. Now, you know, the mass market guys can offer these kinds of features because they're digital, of course, the luxury guy, and sort of where they sort of separate that out in that price band is going to be really interesting to watch.
The thing that you mentioned the price band, but if you look at like C-Class and what C-Class was, I mean, it was their entry-level car here for a long time. And then now you look at what it is now, it looks like a baby S-Class.
Yeah.
The price is up, what, 38,000 base now. It's no longer a low 30s car. I mean, the price of that C-ish car, I mean, think about the A3. It's almost like the last generation A4 in size. Mm-hmm. These cars have gotten bigger. Now there's this gap below them where they had to fill it in with an A3 or a CLA or the new upcoming 1 Series that's front-wheel drive. It's on the UKL platform. So, I mean, there is this gap that's there.
And what's so interesting is what's driving it, and it's a multi-level thing that's driving it. So number one is they can't build enough, or they can't sell enough S-Classes. So as they come out with all this great technology, they've got to diffuse it, the cost of that, by selling more volume.
Well, in the S-Class, for instance, and I experienced this recently, so the S-Class has this autonomous drive system.
It sucks. I just drove it. It's not the hype, man.
Well, you want? Yeah. No,
I disagree.
Well, I kind of disagree too, John. I think the problem is that they hobbled it because they were afraid their lawyers. You know,
their lawyers hobbled them. Yes,
their lawyers in the United States. Their lawyers hobbled them. But conceptually, it's very cool. But nonetheless, I guess the point I'm trying to make is, okay, so this is kind of this, you know, S-class feature. And then you find out from Mercedes folks, like, well, but we're going to have this in the C and the E. They're not even waiting a year to push this stuff down.
Yeah, sure.
Their whole thing is we got to scale all this stuff
as fast as possible.
As fast as possible.
So we got to get into segments that have more volume. And whether it's the 95 gram CO2 in Europe or the California CO2, they've got to get cars that'll balance out the big stuff that really pumps out the hydrocarbons.
And so two numbers here that are sort of interesting in this whole discussion. A3 this year compared to last July, it's up 10,465.2%. Last July they sold 23.
Yeah, well, it was the closeout on the old
hatchback.
And then this year it's 2,430. So climate control or not?
It's a sedan, which Americans prefer. The older one was a hatch, and it was dimensionally challenged.
How many did Cadillac sell of the ATS last month?
Not many. ATS 2,804.
Ooh, brutal.
That hurts.
So that means
So A3. I mean,
it's like a 300 unit.
Yeah, so, and Cadillac's probably not happy with their number, and Audi is probably delighted with theirs.
Yeah, well, ATS is down 17%.
2 months ago, Audi outsold Cadillac, and I don't think there's any looking back.
Let's see. Well, so July, 17,101 for Audi, and Cadillac total is 16,650.
Again.
So they sold it again.
Yeah.
And Dr. Botox, who's looking at more pages and numbers than I am.
He's Eddie.
This is a throwdown to you guys, okay? He points out that the CLA sold 4,875 units last October. Now they average under 2,000 units per month. Why do these guys think it's hot? Guys?
Well, Dave, you first.
My opinion is that there was a lot of people, there was some pent-up demand for it, but I think that, you know, there's some compromises that were made. I think when you drive it, the transmission is not up to par for Americans.
I think I'd agree with that. It is smooth it up.
It needs to be adjusted for American preferences. I mean, you can look at what happened with Ford with the Focus and the Fiesta launch with their dual clutch transmission. It was disastrous. So, you know, that's one issue. I think when people drive it, it doesn't feel premium to them. It doesn't shift smoothly.
I'm not a fan of the CLA.
I like the way it looks from the exterior.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Doesn't hot mean go like this, not go like this?
Yeah. Well, I think yes. And I'll the other thing that I'm, you know, I guess I need to see the inventories. So I'll say, without having checked inventory on this, I'll say what I'm about to say, and then I'll be proven wrong. I also think that from what I hear because I've asked about this, and the story coming out of Mercedes USA is that you know, they're fighting for allocation. I guess they build this in one plant in Hungary or somewhere like that?
Or I think so.
Somewhere in Eastern Europe. Anyway, they're fighting for allocation with particularly China, mainly China. And so there may be a supply issue there. I say may. You know, if the data contradicts me, I stand corrected. But I also think, you know, that, you know, the arrival of the A3 and the other competitive models in this sort of the segment that's being defined as we speak, you know, makes life tougher for the CLA in its current form.
There was also a delay on the not a delay, but the all-wheel drive is launching after. So it was only available in front-wheel drive. The A3, you've been able to get Quattro for since launch.
Okay, yeah. Well,
so there's a couple of
things. I got to give this one to Dr. Botox. You guys are wrong. It's not hot.
Yeah.
It could heat up.
It's not hot.
It looks good. It was like a comet, okay? Bang. Gone. Okay,
it looks good, but there's a lot of compromises that you'd have to make.
He was right, and somebody suggests he'll be on show next week.
Well, let's put it this way. Mercedes, you know, Dr. Z may live to regret this decision, but don't forget, they're building a plant down in Mexico to build CLAs and GLAs in the NAFTA zone. They clearly think that they can sell way more of the next generation of this car than 2,000 a month.
And Infiniti has a version of it coming.
And
they're going to build it in the same plant with
And the other thing, too, is as you look at the German automakers, BMW, Daimler, and Volkswagen Group, especially Daimler and BMW, when you start looking at them from a revenue and from a profit standpoint as a corporation, wow.
Yeah,
wow.
They're doing very well right now, and I mean, the U.S. and China are the two reasons why. Yeah.
Hey, we're going to take another break here in just a second, but let's talk about what's going on at Nissan with Carlos Ghosn.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. So the other news, of course, this week is Nissan has lost yet another executive, top level. Andy Palmer, in charge of a whole bunch of things there.
Yeah, planning chief for Nissan.
Yeah.
He was running, I mean, Andy had just been handed off Infiniti.
Right.
You know, in the last few
weeks.
Johan
leaves, yeah. And Andy gets the job. I think it's far less conspiratorial than you probably do, John. Okay, so he loses Simon Sproul, who goes
corporate
to
communications.
Corporate communications, right. Goes to Tesla. Why did Simon leave? Because Simon wants to move back to California. Okay, so there's no mystery there. And so think about it. So there he is. He's working in Paris and Tokyo, I think his offices were. And
he looked like he never slept.
Right, and so he's going to say, you know, gee, Carlos, I really would like to take a different job, so I go back to California. That ain't going to happen. So he goes and works for Elon Musk, so, you know, not so bad. Andy Palmer, okay? So he leaves, he goes to Aston Martin, right? Okay, so Aston Martin is a company that is basically, it's creating the new Lagonda car, and you can only get it if they invite you. to make a purchase.
I've been checking my inbox every hour.
I mean, so it's just like, so what? I mean, what the hell? I mean, so it'd be like, what a great job that would be to
but
have.
But and it's like basically his hometown car company, and he grew
right.
up, I think,
yeah.
Like
30
so, far away.
So, I mean, there's no mystery there. And number three, okay. Carlos Tavares, and he left, right? And he went to PSA, right? Okay. But if we go back in time, didn't he have that interview whereby he said he'd like to be the CEO of a car company?
Yeah.
Yes.
So A, you're saying that while your boss is there and he's reading this. And then B, somebody says, hey, we've got a car company. Would you like to be the CEO?
Yeah.
Places? What the hell?
And you don't even have to move.
Yeah. It's just like this is just it's not well, Carlos is a bastard. It's like people want to live their lives.
Well, and I think I think it's a lot of what Gary's saying about that. And the other thing is that the auto industry is more dynamic. It has been, but I mean, this is another reminder. It's a more dynamic industry. It's more like a real industry, you know, a real competitive industry where I mean, in Silicon Valley, people jump ship. I look up the LinkedIn profiles of people that I meet, you know, who deal with Silicon Valley, and they've been in half a dozen companies, and you think nothing of it. In fact, if you've been at one company your whole life, they think something wrong with you. I don't know if the auto industry is going to get to quite that level, but I do think the sort of, you know, the dynamics at Renault-Nissan suggest that, you know, you've got smart, ambitious people.
Then why aren't they bailing out of other companies?
I think
very telling that these four executives we just talked about are direct reports to Carlos Ghosn. I see a connection.
But if they weren't direct reports, we wouldn't know.
Well, right, and Nissan and Renault have hired. I mean, I asked about this, and funnily enough, they gave me a list. I mean, and I can't remember the names off the top of my head, but you know, they have a half a dozen executives that they've poached from other companies, either to backfill from some of the folks who quit, or just they needed somebody. I think it's not that people don't want to work for Renault, Nissan, or Carlos Ghosn. I take Gary's side on this one. But I do think that direct reports to Carlos Ghosn have a certain appeal. The Andy Palmer thing is interesting because, you know, one of the things that I believe Aston Martin desperately needs in this world is more partnerships and more alliances to get...
They're in trouble.
Yeah, to get the very expensive technology they're going to need to survive in any form as an independent company. I'm not even sure they can.
Guess what
Andy Palmer knows how to do? He knows how to work alliances. He worked one with Daimler. Well, oh, wait, Daimler has an alliance with Aston. I wonder if...
Well, close your ears, but there was a Reuters story out today about that, saying that a couple of years ago he had tried to get Nissan going to invest money in Aston Martin.
And, oh, really? Okay. Well, good story.
When they said no, kind of opened up the door for him.
But Ulrich Bez, who had been running Aston, retired how long ago? 7-8 months ago?
Retired?
Well, he was 70 years old, you know? Yeah. Okay, so I'll cut him some slack. It was time to go. They can't find a CEO for that company in 8 months, and now Andy Palmer goes there. I don't think that the Aston job was all that attractive to people in the industry.
Well, I think
unless you want a challenge,
unless you want to go home.
Everybody just wanted to go home.
Yeah, he's got four kids. He's got four kids. I don't know how old they are.
Click your heels together and say, "There's no place home. There's no place like home."
That's great.
No, I think.
Let's put it this way. I've met Andy Palmer a few times, spoke to him. I think he's a very smart guy. I don't think he's like a reckless, career-destroying kind of a guy. I'm sure he has a vision that gets him from, you know, A to Z there. And it will be interesting because Aston Martin is one of the, it's one of those brands that's iconic in its own way, and yet very vulnerable, kind of out there on its own little raft. And someone's got to steer it into port. Why not Andy?
And taking people from other industries, you know, this week on Nissan here, you know, poached a guy from Disney for marketing communications. So
no, like
it can.
Well, look at the guy that's
right,
running Nissan North America, or Jose Munoz. He can't. He was nuclear power plant physicist or something, or an engineer. So, that guy's now running, you know, the Americas, and he's not even like a diehard car guy. He wasn't born into it or anything.
And so he'll probably even go to CERN at some point, you know, and just
right.
Smash atoms.
That's right. Go back to where he came from.
But, you know, I think you're right. Look, I mean, Carlos Ghosn, I think, is now 60 years old, and he's got contracts at Renault for the next 4 years, I believe, and he was re-upped for two technically at Nissan. And they're not terribly transparent about the succession plan, at least not to my mind, at Renault Nissan.
He's clearly said that we prefer to have a Japanese person
at Nissan. Yeah, right. And I think the number two guy, from what I'm told, the number two guy at Nissan now probably is the one. And that just sort of clarifies that perhaps. But yeah, I think the interesting Carlos Ghosn is obviously this guy's kind of held this whole thing together by just the force of will and his own personality and his vision, and you sort of wonder, well, how much longer is he going to do that? And will who is it that can do what he does?
He's been doing it for 15 years. Right. There's like nobody. I mean, he's like superhuman.
Right.
To take a French company
that comic book with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Take a French company with a whole bunch of problems and a Japanese company that was a couple weeks from going bankrupt, and they're huge. I mean, they're combined. I think they're bigger than Ford globally. I mean, it's a huge company.
Sergio ought to be taking some serious notes here.
Sergio is right up there, right behind him in terms of, you know, running two companies that have a fair share of issues.
But Sergio doesn't have Renault Nissan's scale.
No, he does not.
And that's a big deal.
It is. Hey, we've got a bunch of questions coming in here. Why don't we get to some of these? Doug makes a point. He says, speaking of price points of brands, this is one reason the Impala is losing steam. Is the Impala too expensive?
Well,
I think so.
It was a fleet queen before. So, you know, they were happy to sell a zillion of them at huge discounts. So I don't think it's a matter of sales. It's a matter of profitability. This car has a lot more content in it now. And you got to remember, too, they're still making the old one in Canada, and they're going to be cutting that out. So, yes, the sales are going to go down. And GM, originally, when I worked at a supplier, they were happy with having lower volume for that car. That was part of the whole plan, to preserve the name and have people with, you know, keep the residual values high. And the sales are going to go down, but the price of the transaction price is going to go way up,
which will pay off in the long run.
So the plan was to go down by 10.6% year to date and 26% for the month. I don't think so.
No, but you don't know what the breakup is between the old Impala and the new Impala. Okay, so that's the problem, is that we know they're putting them all together.
Right, but I mean, even if you look at the total number of sales in August for the Impala, it was 9,802 cars. Okay, they sold 8,134 Camaros, for God's sake. So, I mean, so from a car that was once a bread and butter vehicle to go down to this sort of rarefied air where you have these small volumes like Camaros. I mean, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, but you got to combine all the, you know, you got to look at the parts that it's shared with, the platforms. I mean, you can't just look at one car anymore. You got to look at, they've spread all the cost out all these other cars. So it's not like, you know, the LaCrosse, the XTS, and all the other Epsilon cars that are smaller than that. So if you, you know, start combining these cars, it's not necessarily, the business case isn't that bad.
But that, but that segment overall, I think.
It's shrinking.
It's shrinking. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, what we used to think of as a mid-sized car and now sort of think of as a large car, I guess, you know, is that whole segment is shrinking. And again,
maybe if we get back to this whole notion of stable gas prices and people are going to want more room and
I think a lot of those people, not all, not, you know, 9,000 or so people of last month voted against what I'm about to say. But I think that, you know, the Chevy Traverse gets some of that business that, you know, years ago might have gone to a car like the Impala.
Could well be.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got a phone call in here. Ben, let's bring in that call.
Yes, this is Jim Fikeson from Venice, Florida, in regards to one of your subjects this evening, and that's about fuel cell, is it for fools? Well, in Norway, they're already putting in a complete hydrogen highway infrastructure for the fuel cell cars that are being made by Mitsubishi and Nissan. No, it's not a fool's folly. Europe and Asia are already on track to do this. We have to keep the Exxons and the Shells from not allowing us to go to a proven, it's water, basically, and it's easily producible. Why don't you talk about that this evening, if you will?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any.
After hours.
Thanks for the phone call. But I'm not aware of any fuel cell cars from Mitsubishi or Nissan for sale anywhere in the world, much less Norway.
I'm not aware, but I mean, I know Norway is actually a big promoter of the electric cars. Elon Musk has been over there recently.
Iceland is the one that's talking about going hydrogen because they want to use their geothermal energy to be able to manufacture hydrogen.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, hydrogen still isn't easy to manufacture either. It actually requires quite a bit of energy still to make. So,
very energy intensive.
Yeah. There's still some hurdles, of course.
Although it is a waste gas to a lot of chemical processes. So where you have chemical factories, you can just vent that off and get the hydrogen. But by and large, the other things are pretty energy intensive to break it up. But to the caller's point, going back to the UC Davis thing, they point out that California recently awarded $46 million to build 28 hydrogen fueling stations in California, and so Hyundai's is beginning to lease the Tucson fuel cell vehicle. Toyota announced they're going to have a fuel cell vehicle next year.
The B class has been on sale here.
You got the Honda's going to come out with theirs. BMW is supposed to come out with one. Nissan and Daimler. Supposed to have production vehicles.
Nissan, Daimler, and Ford are all working together.
In vehicle,
and
know,
GM and
in
Honda.
The next few years.
GM and Honda are developing them together as well.
So, you know, there's clearly activity, and I think it gets back to this whole point of you know, as you were saying earlier, John, that, you know, in order to meet whether it's the, you know, the Euro standards or what we're going to have in terms of CAFE here, you know, in 2025 isn't that long in terms of vehicle cycles.
A fuel cell car is an electric car.
Right, right.
It's just instead of storing it in a battery pack, you're storing it in a tank with hydrogen in it.
Sure.
We've been making electric cars for 130 years, and you know, today we're making cars that the ones that people can actually afford have 80 miles of range. Okay, well, this is just a stepping stone to hydrogen. I mean, there's no... 10 years ago, if you had asked me about hydrogen, I would have been like, ah, that's really funny. But, I mean, now it's actually really, it's feasible. I mean, Toyota just, they've been able to lower the cost on the Highlander fuel cell vehicle that they have. In the last 10 years, they've lowered the cost for the whole powertrain by 95%. So we're not into the, is this technology going to work? It works. We're into the cost-cutting phase now.
Right. So, In fact, Michael Bryan, who was on the show earlier this summer from Hyundai, made the exact point that you're making, is they see a cost reduction path with fuel cells.
With hydrogen and fuel cells.
Hydrogen fuel cells. He says, we see the path. Now we have to get there, but we see the path. He says, we at Hyundai don't see that path with batteries.
Other than Elon Musk, who takes a very different view, I mean, very few people I talk to at large car companies see a path.
Well, and it'll
for
be
the batteries.
It'll be interesting to watch Musk, because with the Model 3 that's coming, this will be, you know, right now he's taken a battery pack and basically made it out of a bunch of laptop battery cells. This next pack is supposed to be one that's more of an automotive grade battery pack that you would find in a Leaf or something else. So it's going to be really interesting to see how he can get the range that he's claiming and the cost and everything by using the technology that everybody else is really using.
Right, but if he just from scale alone, he's going to be able to drive the cost down of those things.
That's his argument.
Yeah,
because you know, you talk to guys who are involved in making the fuel cells it's pretty much like making jewelry right now. I mean, these guys are, you know, working with precious metals, and it's a very, very delicate thing. You productionize that, right? You try to get some of those precious metals out, and pretty soon, as you begin to scale, your prices go down.
I mean, we look at catalytic converters. You know, when they started, they were extremely expensive. I mean, we've been able to really get some efficiencies there.
You know, and it seems like, you know, whether it's the battery path or it's just the pure hydrogen path, I mean, you're seeing that there are lots of smart people who are really, really thinking hard and working hard and investing a lot of time, effort, energy, and money in doing this stuff. And I think that it's inevitable that we're going to be seeing breakthroughs as we go forward.
But I think, I guess my guess about this, though, is that adoption, particularly in the United States, where, you know, cheap energy is kind of what we do, and cheap hydrocarbons are what we do. I think in the United States, the uptake on all these alternatives to petroleum-fueled vehicles are going to come a lot slower. Because I just think, you know, the installed base on gasoline and to some extent diesel-fueled vehicles, and the reliability and the range and the ease of fueling and all those things. I mean, I think if you spend a lot of time listening to people talk about fuel cells and electric cars, you know, you sort of think, yeah, why not? It's going to happen. Yeah, but it's going to happen slowly.
I would agree with that. And the other thing, too, is, and this gets back to the caller's point, you know, he doesn't want the big oil driving everything. As oil, big oil, faces more and more competition, whether it's batteries, natural gas, fuel cells or the like, they're going to have to compete on price. That could even pull gasoline prices cheaper.
Well, right, which cuts against mass market demand for, you know, a less energy dense alternative technology. So it's going to be tricky, and I think it'll be interesting.
It's all about a gas tax, but nobody's going to do it.
Nobody wants to do it, right.
Well, see, when they buy all those lingots in China, they're going to need more fuel in China, and therefore
it'll all go there.
There you go. Buy electric cars here.
Hey, look, we're at the top of the hour here, probably a good place to wrap it all up. But great discussion, great information. Again, you know, that's what I love about this show and for all the viewers, too. Great opportunity to learn a lot of what's going on. And that's because we got people like Joe White from The Wall Street Journal and Dave Sullivan from Auto Pacific and my great co-host, Gary Vasilash from Automotive Design and Production Magazine.
Thank you guys for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.